The subject this morning is Swami Atulananda, the great American Vedantin. He was actually born in Holland and emigrated to the United States probably 1880s or something like that. He met a number of the direct disciples of of Sri Ramakrishna. He met probably first of all Swami Abhedananda, who was teaching in New York at that time, who had been brought to this country by Swami Vivekananda on his second trip to the West. And he also met and was greatly influenced, primarily influenced, one could say, by Swami Turiyananda, who also came to the West in the 1890s with Swami Vivekananda. Actually, Swami Abhedananda came first to England and then to the United States. Swami Turiyananda came, his first assignment was on the East Coast. He taught in New York and New Jersey. Then he founded the Shanti Ashrama in California. And that ashrama was actually founded because of Swami Atulananda, whom we are speaking about today. He was an extremely earnest person and very serious about his spiritual development, his spiritual practices. He had adopted all sorts of modes of earning his living, whatever was available to him at that time. But his main interest was, once he heard the teachings of Vedanta as expounded by Swami, primarily Swami Turiyananda and Swami Abhedananda. Later he also met Swami Vivekananda. Anyway, if the teachings of Vedanta are true and beneficent and worthwhile, then just to acknowledge that in a theoretical way is by no means enough. And that, of course, is how we should feel also. That just to acknowledge that we find something interesting and attractive and somewhat satisfying in the ancient teachings that Vedanta propounds and that the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita discuss, just to acknowledge that is certainly not satisfactory. One has to try to also realize those things. And that is the lesson for all of us. It is what Swami Atulananda, in his natural bent, in his natural seriousness of mind and seriousness of purpose, what he did is something that each one of us should undertake. If we feel that some teachings are significant for our life, that they answer certain basic questions, that they are probably going to be beneficial to us in so many ways, then just to acknowledge that is by no means enough. We have to do something about it. Otherwise, it is a theoretical satisfaction, but has no direct influence on our life or experience. So Swami Atulananda's development, you could say, is something that we should take very seriously and consider for our own spiritual, emotional, intellectual, psychological well-being. He was extremely attracted to these teachings. I felt great satisfaction from hearing the teachings and wanted to put them into practice. That is to say, he wanted to undertake the spiritual disciplines, the spiritual training that is necessary to try to ourselves realize that in our own lives. But how was he going to do that? I mean, he had to earn a living, and in those days, as in these days also, that takes up most of our time. And nearly all of us, what we have to do is somehow make time for that spiritual development. So we establish meditation times in the morning and in the evening, and we attend events that discuss the teachings, the spiritual instructions. We get, we approach teachers for spiritual instructions, all those things we do. And this is what Swami Atulananda, who was named, his original name was Cornelius Heblom, a Dutch name. He was born in Holland. But he felt that a great intensity and earnestness to try to put these things into practice. So he tried, he went to a place called the Lord's Farm, which was a spiritual organization, a Christian spiritual organization in upstate New York. But somehow that wasn't quite fitting for his particular needs, although he appreciated very much the type of life that they were living. So this matter was being discussed in the Vedanta Society of New York at that time, and it was felt that there should be in the United States something that is historically prevalent in India and has been for literally thousands of years, namely something that can be called an ashrama, a place that is devoted to spiritual purposes exclusively, and where people come from time to time, and as their circumstances in life permit, they come from time to time and spend their days in a certain series of spiritual practices, meditations, and to try to realize, to try to achieve that which they have theoretically understood. That is the main thing. Sometimes religion is thought to be something I believe. Believe in this and you're considered religious. Certainly that is a step on the religious, on the spiritual path. But the achievement of that type of belief has to be on a foundation of realization. And realization doesn't necessarily mean the higher spiritual realizations or profound spiritual experiences, but it implies whatever is appropriate to our own particular status at that time. At least it should imply a firm conviction that the path has been examined, we have studied the path, we have examined it, we found it to be suitable for ourselves. That is the first step, but that is only the very first step. The second step is, what do we need to do in order to actually make this real in our lives? Otherwise, we can read about all the saints and sages and we get very much inspired, and that's of great benefit, no doubt. But ultimately, it doesn't really accomplish the whole job. It doesn't do everything that needs to be done. It's very, you could say, it's the beginning of the process, and good for that reason. But it cannot be the sole practice. One has to transform it into what one believes in theory, what one has accepted as an idea, has to be made a realization. We have to actually experience the truth of it. And that is, of course, a very scientific approach. Science is not just based on theories of this and that, but every theory has to be, in order to be fully accepted, has to be verifiable and verified. Not only verified once by someone, I mean that Newton discovered this and Galileo discovered that and Einstein discovered something else, and we get all the proofs that they have written in order to show their, to substantiate their realizations. That's not enough. We have to be able to write those, the same thing ourselves. We have to have the experiences that substantiate this so that it is not simply a belief on our part, but an actual realization. So how does one do this? And the traditional prescriptions for this given in the ancient scriptures are certain forms of spiritual practice, so that what is real and obvious now is seen to be only a part of the reality, that it is based on a foundation which is profound and which is unshakable. Everything that we realize now can be destroyed, can be torn apart, as it were, by circumstances. But we want to realize something which is the unshakable foundation of our existence, the unshakable foundation of the universe. First question is there such a thing? And for that, the scriptures are used to point out to the fact that, yes, there is such a thing. There is an unshakable foundation. These things, the things that are on the surface, that are merely appearances, they come and go. But there is a reality at the heart of every experience that does not come and go. A reality that is permanent and unchangeable. And the great souls who have taught us, they have again and again maintained that by the realization of that which does not change, if you call it God or the Spirit or Brahman or the reality or the, you know, whatever you want, name you want to give it, at the heart of every religion, what is the heart, what really is the heart of every religion, is its insistence that there is something unchangeable. And the belief that there is something unchangeable, which you call God or whatever name you give to it, the Spirit, Brahman, the, you know, whatever name it acquires, to aver such a thing, proclaim that there is such a thing, is the very, very lowest, simplest, fundamental beginning of the process. That should be something which impels us to try to actually make it our realization, not just something that we intellectually accept and claim an understanding of, but something that we actually experience, that we, it is a very scientific process. The laws are there, the laws are accepted, but the laws are tested and found to be true. So that is the same thing that we, or every generation in turn, has to face and to try to satisfy. So Swami Atulananda was in that state where he wanted to not only accept, he very much appreciated the teachings of these great Swamis, disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, but he wanted to actually make that his own realization. But how to do that in his particular circumstances was his problem. This was being discussed at the Vedanta Society in New York, and there was a lady there who was from California, and she had inherited a certain piece of property not far from San Francisco, a few hours drive from San Francisco, but far enough away to be isolated, and she was willing and anxious to give that property to Swami Vivekananda for the purpose of creating an ashrama, a place where this Gurudas, this Cornelius Heyblom, who had been given the name Gurudas, means the servant of the teacher, where he could spend his time in spiritual practices and try to experience those things which the theory describes, but which experience must later verify. And she offered that property to Swami Vivekananda. He accepted it. And accepted it means accepted the idea of it, and sent Swami Turiyananda, another disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, to Shanti Ashrama, to found this Shanti Ashrama, which he did in 1900, and it flourished for some years. And then the disadvantages became more pronounced, in the sense that it is relatively far from the San Francisco area. It is extremely hot in the summer and extremely cold, with a certain amount of snow in the winter. It's at about 2,200 feet elevation, so even though the rest of the Bay Area doesn't have snow, that area is subject to that in winter. So it was not really suitable, and other Swami Trigunatija made an effort to establish a colony in Kalkar, and finally Swami Ashokananda established our retreat in, our present retreat in Olema in Marin County. But this, the impetus for it all really was the desire to provide such a place in the United States, and this Swami, who became Swami Atulananda, it was really his needs that started that process. So this places him in the sort of in the history of the Vedanta movement. After some years at the Shanti Ashrama, he wanted to go to India and actually partake of the monastic life there, as it was lived there, and he came back to the United States and went again like that for some years. Finally, he decided that he wanted to stay there full time. And he eventually passed away there in about 1965 or 1966. Highly revered by the monks of our order for his spiritual accomplishments. He didn't write anything, but he kept sort of notes, and some of these notes were later published. There were different editions came out and so forth. So anyway, that is the, what we want to discuss today is the conclusions that you might say that he came to. The fact that he was, you know, that he was living here in this ashrama, and that he had certain experiences here, and then had further experiences in India after he went. He tried several times to go there, but there were, for various reasons, he couldn't, it was difficult to adjust to Indian conditions. Eventually he did adjust, and he stayed there probably from about 1920 or something until he passed away in 1965, I think it was. So the question is, what is it that appealed to him? What did he really feel attracted to? What was his basic outlook? Since in many ways he is representative of the type of approach that many of us will have because of his background, European, Northern European background, but also because his subsequent years in the United States, living very much in conditions that are very similar to the conditions that we have to face. What is it that attracted him? And what is it that he tried to embody in his own life? Of course, he was raised in a Christian family, so that was his background, which is also the background of most of us. So in many ways that his experiences form a framework that might also become significant to us. His approach was mainly what is called the non-dualistic approach. In other words, that can be phrased in this way, that there is, in this universe, what is our experience? We are faced with so many conditions. We were born in a certain place, in a certain family. We are educated in a certain way. We live our mature life devoted to a certain profession and certain activities, and then we come to retirement and try to achieve or try to live the way that we had hoped to live while we were forced to go under undergo the rigors of employed existence, and then eventually, having had families and raised the families themselves have families, so slowly we march off the stage and are absorbed in the infinite and eternal, and that seems to be the end of it. Of course, if you have the theory of reincarnation, that experience won't be the end. It'll be, things will reappear and continue. But anyway, the same process goes on and on. If there's reincarnation, means you go through it an unknown number of times. If you don't accept reincarnation, still you're going through it once, so the basic problem remains. So what did Swami Atulananda, what was closest to his heart, what were the ideas that really impelled him? And the basic, of course, if you want to, the scriptural background of it, it is the Upanishads. The Upanishads and their commentaries, because the Upanishads are interpreted in a very non-dualistic way, or it can be interpreted at various levels of dualistic perception. Non-dualistic means that Ekam sad vipra bahudha vadanti. Truth is one, but sages describe it in different ways. That's one of the basic statements of the Rig Veda, and it simply describes the situation in which we find ourselves. But it makes the additional statement that sages who experience this truth need not describe it in the same way. It isn't that there is one truth, and that is what I want to find, the one truth. There is one reality, that statement is made, but the truth of it, that is the expression that we perceive, the expression that we understand of that truth, will vary. It can be seen in many different ways. There is one mountain here, and if I look at it from one side, it looks this way. If I look at it from the other side, it could be a totally different terrain, and I may not even be able to recognize it as being the same mountain. But the fact remains, it is the same mountain, but it appears in different ways. So this religion, that is to say, that spiritual understanding of what is at the basis of our life, the spiritual foundation of existence, God, the Spirit, or whatever name you want to give it, will be described differently by people who have experienced it, each one of them as a genuine experience of that reality, and it is not to be understood as being different approximations, and that you come to a better and better and a more perfect realization, and then one religion will claim this is the perfect realization, and another religion will claim something else is the perfect realization. The point is, there is one mountain, and people look at it from different sides and come to different conclusions about it. None of them are wrong, because what they see is actually there. But it's not the only way of describing that mountain. That reality can be described in other ways, and even though the ways seem to be contradictory, it is the same thing that is being described. And that is the glory of these formulations that Vedanta describes. Of each religion can be formulated in the same way, but in particular, Vedanta has taken that form since very ancient times, and so here we have, we use it as the basic approach, the basic formulation. So this was what Swami, he will be, Cornelius Abram, who became Gurudas. Gurudas means servant of the teacher. Then he is, when he took sannyasa, took the monastic vows, he became Swami Atulananda. That is what impressed him. And what he wanted is to have that, which of course is basically our want of every serious spiritual seeker, to have that experience, which is described in different ways, but which is the same object of experience. And in order to do that, there were certain conclusions that he came to. And one of the conclusions is that there is an unchanging reality. I mean, this was his way of phrasing it. He got these, all these conclusions are the teachings of, you know, of Vedanta, but he put it in his own way. That whatever is seen as changing is perceived against the background that is unchanging. And if you think about it, you really cannot perceive change unless there is something unchangeable. If you say that there is nothing firm, there's nothing, I don't know God is that which never changes, but I don't see anything that like that, I don't see anything that does not change. All I perceive are things which, yes, they're all right, they're the same for some time, then they decay and disappear. One talks about six changes. Things are born, things are developed, they grow, and then they slowly, they mature, and then they begin to decay, and eventually they are destroyed and they disappear. So the point is that there is something which never disappears. That is the thing. One of the things that does disappear is the light on this podium. But anyway, I can't do anything about that. It re-emphasizes the idea that you cannot perceive change unless there is something changeless. That is really a very profound idea. Normally you say there is change, I don't see anything changeless. I don't see God, I don't see the Spirit, I don't see that which doesn't change. But you cannot perceive change unless you yourself are changing less, or changing in a different way. There are two trains that are moving next to each other. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a rather weird phenomenon. You're sitting in a train and another train is going by, or you seem to be going by, and it's not possible to tell which one is moving. But the point is that there is someone making that judgment. There is something somewhere which is not moving. The train, you have, the person on the train cannot necessarily say who is moving. But there you would not be able to perceive the unchanging unless there is something basic and fundamental in your perception which is already unchanging. In other words, if we did not have the awareness of the infinite and the eternal, we could not really find any anchor in the changing either. So the statement that there is something unchanging is of that nature. So the fact that, so that fact means that within us there is something, within our perception, within our consciousness, within our knowledge, or maybe our memory, there is something which identifies change. And that is not changing. And this is the psychological foundation, you could say, of that idea of changelessness. You could also sometimes put this way: if you see something changing, that means you are changing less than that. But then that leaves open the possibility somebody else can look at you and find something that is changing, and he also perceives that only because in him there's something that is changing less. Ultimately, the ultimate level is that there must be something which doesn't change at all. But these are just psychological or, or logical arguments. They won't be convincing, but the whole purpose of meditation is to reach within ourselves a point which does not change, and to see that within our consciousness there is an element of changelessness. And that element is the knowers of Brahman, the knowers of that reality who have experienced that. They say that that element within ourselves is what is at the heart of the whole universe also, that our perception of external things is because we see the unchanging, and on the unchanging we superimpose all these changing phenomena. It is a very sort of simplistic way of looking at it, is that there's a screen. Our experience is a screen. What we see is on a screen. What we see is constantly changing, but the screen never changes. And that's what we're trying to realize in meditation. We're trying to go beyond, to go to that level within us which does not change, and from which we're able to see change. And if we come to that level which is changeless, that must be the eternal, the infinite, the divine reality that we're looking for, because it is its basic characteristic is this changelessness. Now, the Upanishads are all the basis, you know, of all of this. What is here is there, what is there is here. He goes from death to death who sees, as it were, things changing. This is an ancient Vedantic idea which the Upanishads constantly emphasize. There is a reality within our experience which is constantly changing. There is a reality which doesn't change. That reality, if we become identified with it, that is the permanent, that is the unchangeable, and that is the divine principle, the divine reality. And this is what appealed to Swami Atulananda most. So some of the things that he said he said at one point, that which is try to find out what is real in life, that which does not change. Another one of his statement is, the one is appearing as many. In fact, toward the end of his life, that was one of the last statements that he made. He actually had that experience in which he saw that the many that changes our perceptions, different perceptions of the same reality. One of his advice, try to find out what is real in life. He was asked this question, are you aware of that truth which we are and which is the only reality behind all these phenomena? And his answer was, often I am aware of this sense world, and at times I am aware of that reality. This awareness has to be brought to mind repeatedly, and it has to become natural. The highest experience, he was talking about the Ashtavakra Gita, Ashtavakra Samhita. He said the highest experience is what is most tempting. And that is experienced as the reality of the self alone. The reality where there is no world, nothing exists beside the self. There's no appearance even. For appearance is brought about by ignorance, and the negation of appearance can only take place in ignorance. So he was, what you could say, he accepted this non-dual presentation of Vedanta as what was most appreciated by him, most accepted by him. And his whole life became devoted to the attempt to constantly perceive that, to perceive that reality. And one of the significant things about it is that this realization, this series of realizations that he had that made him arrive at these conclusions were held under circumstances which are very similar to the circumstances that we live in. So this isn't the point that only a person living in an ashrama far away somewhere can achieve. This is something which one can see. One can, anyone living in whatever circumstances, this experience can be reached. As Swami Vivekananda said, this if you stand on Market Street, and of course in those days there was streetcars and all these things, if you stand on Market Street and you watch the traffic and you hear the noise and all of these things happening, you should be... Oh, thank you. It's called emergency procedures. Yeah. Voice is all right until I come here, then something happens. I don't know what it is. Anyway, the point is, standing on Market Street, as Swamiji said, watching all the traffic and all the hustle and bustle, is your mind as calm as if you were on the desert, on a desert island? And on a desert, if you're standing, living on a desert island, is your mind fully embracing that, not the surface, the calm surface, but the foundation, the unshakable foundation that is at the heart of every manifestation? The purpose of meditation is to calm the exterior to the extent that the interior will manifest itself. That's why we sit calmly, quietly, and with great concentration and attention, trying to concentrate on one thing. Because at the heart of everything that we concentrate on, at the heart of everything, there is that unchangeable basis. And if we can go beyond the movements on the surface and reach the unmoving heart, we're reaching the unmoving heart of the whole universe. So this Swami Atulananda, he achieved great progress in that direction, and he was highly respected by the monks of the order, and people used to come to him, even though he was living in seclusion in the foothills of the Himalayas for the last decades of his life. People used to come and see him and try to be impelled or be inspired to follow that example. So this was a person who started, like all of us, in this particular world. He was not, this is not in ancient days where when the scriptures were composed, this is these days, this has happened, this is possible for all of us. And that should be the goal that we set for ourselves, to realize that which is infinite, that which is eternal, that which is the foundation of everything that seems to change, that unchangeable reality. Thank you.